Hi, Don and Arielle. Thanks so much for inviting Charles and I to be on your new blog-in network radio. Yesterday I didn't even know what a blog was, and here we are. I thought I would start at the beginning. My name is Marie Hall, and my husband Charles James Hall authored the Millennial Hospitality series of 3 books so far. And I thought I'd just tell you how it was from the beginning when I met him. He had been out of the service and back from Vietnam for a year when I met him in the summer of 69. We got married in the fall, and on the 1st of January, we moved to Sacramento, California. Some substitute teaching, but mostly my job was that of apartment manager. And we got invited to a party, and I noticed that Charles wasn't having a real good time and wanted to leave early, which we did. And he'd probably had 2 beers, so he was in a little bit of more of a mood to talk than ordinary. And he told me about the amazing experiences that he had out in the desert at Indian Springs, Nevada. He told me about tall white extraterrestrials coming into his barracks at night. Well, to be honest, I thought it was just a one-time thing. I didn't realize that this went on for over 2 years. And all I said at the time was, you know, I really hadn't given any thought to whether they existed or not, and I couldn't say that I cared whether they existed or not. I just hoped that if I ever met one, that I would behave in a manner that was a credit to the human race. Well, we spent the next 32 and a half years raising a family. I have 6 children, and when Charles became unemployed a little over 3 years ago, I came into the computer room, and he very quickly shut the screen. And I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Oh, I'm working on a book." And I said, "Really?" He said, "You know, I would like to see that. If you died tomorrow, I'm sure it would be a job going through the 1,000 files you have on your computer to find a book." And he printed out 2 of the chapters, and I went in the other room and I started reading. And I came back and I said, "We're publishing this." And he said, "Oh, no, I don't think so. You know, I was just writing my biography for our children and grandchildren to read." And I said, "Hey, I'm not going to stop them from reading it after we publish it." And he said, "Well, I don't think so. You know, even if you don't write anything bad about somebody, they still could come and sue you." And I said, "Hey, the answer to that is really simple. We'll just write a standard disclaimer, and we'll change the names of all the people. You still have to say it's fiction, because even the names you make up might, in fact, belong to a real person." "Well," he said, as long as you're changing the names of the people, how about if we change the names of the places as well? You know, the nature of the material is such that I would just feel more comfortable if we did that." Well, I was willing to make whatever concession was necessary in order to get him to agree to publish it. He still wasn't too hot on the idea. And finally, I just said, "Charles, you're unemployed. If the men in black come to the front door, you should go with them. It's free room and board." So he finally laughed, and he said, "Okay." So we published first one book, and then a second, and then a third. I bought a bunch of these books and thought we were going to sell, you know, just hundreds of them at the Roswell Festival. which we had been invited to in 2003, and it really wasn't a big book buying crowd. So that was kind of a disappointment to have thousands of dollars worth of books in your garage. Then last winter, the fall of 2004, the books did indeed start selling. We hadn't spent any money on advertising because we felt that the books should sell themselves. And indeed they are. Now, before I go on any further, I do want to let you know that we have a website, millennialhospitality.net. We're selling autographed hardcover copies of the book out of our home, but the book is also available in softcover and ebook as well. And that information is all on our website. In addition, you can purchase these books by ordering them through any bookstore in the world. And indeed, I have shipped books to Germany, Australia, Canada, Hawaii, England, Ireland. At any rate, what I'm going to do is have Charles start and tell his story from the beginning. And then later on, we're going to have Charles answer some of the questions, because we do have fans emailing us daily with just more questions than you can imagine. Remember, the book is written almost like a novel. Charles was trying to capture how it felt for him as a very young man in a very naive time, you know, before Close Encounters, before E.T., in a situation totally without precedent. And in fact, he wasn't trying to prove that extraterrestrials exist. You know, it's hard enough for people to believe that God exists sometimes. He also felt that his children and grandchildren would be reading the book possibly after it was common knowledge that they existed, and it would be no longer necessary to prove anything at all. So let me turn the mic over to Charles now, and he'll get us started on how he first came to know the Tall Whites.
Thanks, Marie. My name is Charles James Hall. I'm the author of the Millennial Hospitality series. And I'll give you a little introduction as to my experiences. On July 24th, 1964, I enlisted in the U.S. Air Force. I grew up in Madison, in Wisconsin, just southeast of Madison. And I did my basic training at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, Texas. And while I was at Lackland, the Air Force gave me lots of tests, along with the other men, to see, you know, what a guy is good at. And I got a perfect score in analytical reasoning, in deductive reasoning, and in inductive reasoning. And also, I got only one wrong on the mathematical ability test, which was 500 questions. And I was supposed to be in radio intercept analysis, which is a security job. So after my basic training ended, I had 13 weeks of it, me and two of my friends, who also were supposed to go to radio intercept analysis, were stationed, remained at Lackland at PATS standing, while we were waiting for our security clearances. And the idea is that when our security clearances came through, then we would be sent to San Angeles, Texas. But if our security clearances didn't come through, then we would be sent to Weather Observer School in Chinook, Illinois. Well, our security clearances came through. Mine, however, when my orders came through, they were highly classified, the orders were kept in the safe in the squadron office. And the captain was supposed to administer them to me. They're supposed to give me my orders. They came through on a Friday, late on a Friday afternoon, and the captain was off, you know, doing whatever captains do. I was an enlisted man. And one of my friends, who was the clerk in the squadron office, he didn't realize that I had a set of, that a set of classified orders existed. So he gave me the orders to Weather Observer School in Chanute, Illinois. Since I had my orders, I got on the bus to Chanute the following day and transferred to Chanute Air Force Base, Illinois. After I was at Chanute for 2 months, I wasn't getting paid because nobody knew I was on the base. I was in weather training school, but, you know, the accountants didn't know I was on base. So I went down to the accounting office and, you know, asked what was, you know, why I wasn't getting paid. And the next day at weather school, 2 MPs showed up with a dog and escorted me over to the base commander's office. And the base commander said, had me standing up there in front of him, and he said, Airman Hall, if you have a set of orders saying that you're supposed to be on this base, then you're a happy man, and the captain who gave them to you will get court-martialed. And he was facing 5 years in Leavenworth. And he said, because you're too valuable a man to be wasted as a weather observer. On the other hand, if you don't have a set of orders, then the captain will be a happy man, and you'll get court-martialed. I had 2 copies of my orders, which I was quite happy to give the general a copy. So then they sent me back to weather school, you know, to finish weather training. And at the end of weather school, when they ask you where you would like to be assigned, I remember asking for March Air Force Base Los Angeles, or for a base in England or a base in Germany. And instead the sergeant said, no, you're going to Nellis outside Las Vegas. That's where the Pentagon wants you. And so when my orders came through, I was sent from Nellis Air Force Base, which is northeast, on the northeast side of Las Vegas, Nevada. And I reported there in March of 1965. And I was at Nellis until May of 1967. In May of 1967, I was sent to Vietnam, where I served in the Delta with the South Vietnamese. And then in May of 1968, when I came back from Vietnam, I received an honorable discharge. Well, I was at Nellis. Nellis has these extensive gunnery ranges at Indian Springs, Nevada, which is about 90 miles northwest of Las Vegas. And it's on the other, when you go up the Indian Springs Valley and over the mountains, you can cross the mountains into Area 51. And so the Nellis gunnery ranges, you know, connect, you know, when you go up in there, they connect with the highly restricted areas up in Area 51 and Area 52 and Area 53 and Area 54. The weather observers before me were doing 6 weeks in turn temporary duty up there, out on the gunnery ranges. Each one in turn would do 6 weeks of PDY and would then be replaced by another one. And in order to do PDY, you're supposed to be off, you're not supposed to be able to do PDY until you finish your on-the-job training, which was supposed to take several months. However, hardly reported to Nellis, it was only late April, and I wasn't anywhere close to finishing my PDY, when my commander was called over by the Nellis base commander to his office, and when he came back, I remember he was looking kind of stunned, and he called me in the office and said, Airman Hall, you'll be replacing, the airman that's at Indian Springs. You'll be the next one going up on PDY. And when I pointed out to him that I hadn't finished my on-the-job training, the major said, that won't matter, the Pentagon wants you to be next. So I reported as ordered. I did my first tour duty up at Indian Springs out in the ranges, and then after 6 weeks I was replaced by another airman. And something happened to him, as described in my books, and so they sent me back to Indian Springs. And then the guy after me, something happened to him, sent me that. And then they went through a selection. Then they formed a committee with both the generals and the aliens who are out in Indian Springs Valley. There's a base out in Area 54 that the U.S. government maintains for the Fall White aliens, as I describe in my books, the Millennial Hospitality Series. And they formed a committee and they picked me to be the so-called permanent range observer. And I remember the day the major, they'd called me back from Ellis, as I described in my book. And the major called me in his office. It was a Sunday. He had ordered me to come in and work the day shift on Sunday when there's nobody else in the weather station or in the base operations building, which the weather station is part of. And then at noon, the Nellis base commander and the number two man came in, and my commander had to report, to the Nellis base commander's office and receive my orders. And then the MPs escorted him, the major, with my orders over to the weather station. And I remember he called me in and he said, and he began reading me my orders. The orders were that I could go anywhere I wanted in dreamland, either day or night, as long as I was alone. And I thought he meant that it was okay if I slept on duty, because, dreamland. And then he said that, that I would be given a name called Teacher's Pet, and that it was a proud name that I should remember, and read me the rest of the orders, that whatever I did, I had to do completely alone. And when he was finished, I wanted to verify the dreamland part, because, so I said to him, I said, will there be a cot out at the weather station for me to sleep in? And the major looked a little confused, and he said that it was his understanding dreamland was a place, but that only I would know where that place was. And that was the first time I'd ever heard tell of dreamland. And dreamland itself is not Area 51. Dreamland itself is areas 53, 54, the eastern side of the Indian Springs Valley, those mountains, Dog Bone Lake, and the western side of the Desert Southwest Game Ranges, and a few other places on the western part of the valley. So then after that, I was sent to Indian Springs as TDY, but TDY kind of forever. And it's my experiences during those years are the experiences that I tried to capture in the Millennial Hospitality Series.
Thanks, Charles. And now I'd like to have you answer a few questions. Some of the audience here may have, in fact, read your book. This one was just in yesterday's email. It's from Naomi in the greater New York City area. And she wants to know about the Tall White's interest in the Earth. What do they particularly like or dislike about the Earth?
The Tall White base at Indian Springs is a place, they use the base as a place for their deep spacecraft to land and refuel and repair and then stand out to space again. One of their main interests in the Earth is simply as a place for their deep spacecraft to do that. And the Tall Whites specifically stated that they considered the Earth to be a cold, desolate wilderness. They like it warmer than we do. When the temperatures in Nevada got up above 100, 105, they started feeling comfortable, whereas we as humans, myself, for us that was pretty hot. I remember there was a week when the temperatures were 115, 118 out in the shade, out in the Nevada desert, and they were all out playing in the sunshine. They were very comfortable with those temperatures, whereas, for us that was really hot. And so their interest in there are many parts of the Earth like the poles and, the colder sections that they have no interest whatever in. their main interest in the Earth, as I say, is purely to, as a place for their spacecraft to repair and refuel.
Thank you. I have a number of questions that I know you'll enjoy answering from Thomas. His first question is, if the tall whites are no longer in the area of Nellis Air Force Base, are any of their ships in the possession of the military? I think we should mention that as of June 20th, 2005, that was just a couple months ago, the Indian Springs is no longer called Indian Springs. The new name is Creech Air Force Base.
I'm quite certain that the tall whites are still at their base at, well, Indian Springs, Creech Air Force Base. When you're actually at Indian Springs, Nevada, and you're looking north up the valley, their base is in those mountains on the northern end of the valley. And it's such a perfect location for a base for them. It's not likely that they would ever move it or leave it, you know, go somewhere else. So I feel quite certain that they are still there and their base is still in use.
What do you know about their language? Does it have a written form? And can you reproduce any of the symbols? Does their written language resemble any Earth language?
Their written language is so similar to Egyptian hieroglyphics that some of the men who served with me thought they might have been ancient Egyptians who had somehow or another gotten trapped out in the desert and couldn't get home. Their basic writing, for example, the writing that I would see inside their hangar, inside their hangars on the walls, pink against the white background. And if a person, say like myself, who was not an expert in hieroglyphs, if they didn't know what the real Egyptian hieroglyphs looked like, they could easily confuse their writing with Egyptian hieroglyphs. The tall whites their hearing is at least as good as that of a dog. Their eyesight is at least as good as that of a cat. With their vocal cords, they're able to make any sound that, you know, that any animal here on Earth can make. But like rhinoceroses, they can also make sounds too high for a human to hear. And so when they were out in the desert just communicating with themselves, it frequently sounded like animals. On a sunny day, for example, it would sound like the meadowlark, typically like the western meadowlark, when they were communicating with each other. If at night, or if they wanted to communicate with someone a long distance away, it would sound like a horse whinny. If they were laughing, it frequently sounded like the barking of a dog. And so, you know, their natural language, one time I asked the teacher what her real name was, the teacher was just the name that she had picked for herself, her so-called CIA name, so that a human could address her. And she said that I wouldn't be able to pronounce her real name because it included sounds too high for a human to and too low for a human to hear.
Thanks. Were we able to supply the tall whites with any technology or necessary supplies which they required?
Well, the base, the main hangar at the base, was clearly built by the U.S. Air Force. And the U.S. Air Force clearly supplies them, I'm certain, as I saw, with any supplies they want. That includes food and clothing and replacement parts, if they're available, if we have them, that can be, or raw materials such as titanium or those things. Anything that we're able to provide them, the U.S. Air Force provides to them. Some things, of course, we're not able to provide. However, anything we have that would be of use to them, the Air Force provides to them. That clearly includes food and clothing and shelter and electricity and all those things.
and security.
Yeah, security gone bonkers, yeah.
Since the tall whites have advanced technology, what method was used to keep them within set military boundaries?
They don't stay within set military boundaries. They're very proud of their independence. You know, they didn't come across, you know, 36 light years of space in order to be confined to 36 acres of rock. It was very common to see the tall whites off base. It was very common to see them at night in the town of Indian Springs or it was very common to also see them up on in Mount Charleston, up in Lee Canyon, and out in Front Valley. And they have the deep spacecraft, which they build and come here from, used to come here from other stars. However, they also have the scout craft, which are built here on Earth, using parts provided to them by the U.S. Air Force. The scout craft are perfectly capable of going to the moon or to Mars or to anywhere on Earth. And so, you know, I've seen reports of the tall whites here in New Mexico and in Illinois and Ireland. And so you didn't, they really did not feel confined to the base at Indian Springs.
When speaking English, what characteristics do the tall white voices have? For instance, are men's voices lower than women's voices?
The tall whites, as we mentioned, their vocal cords are so flexible that they can make sounds that, you know, too high and too low for humans to hear. Their vocal cords are so flexible that any one of them sound like any human that they choose to. So as you see in my books, it was no problem whatever for a tall white who, say like Range 4 Harry, who was very proud of his ability to speak English, to call me up on the telephone and sound like any person he felt like sounding like. He sounded like any one of my friends. If he felt like sounding like a woman, he could. In the same way, the women, when they called up on the telephone, if they felt like sounding like any one of my friends, their vocal cords were so flexible that you really couldn't tell the difference. And so when you were talking with the tall whites, there wasn't any difference, you know, there wasn't any particular difference in the way that the men talked as opposed to the way the women talked if they all had learned to speak English. However, each one of the tall whites was very proud of the fact that he was an individual. And so when you were talking with the tall whites, the thing that impressed me wasn't so much noticeable differences in the sound of their voices, it was their personalities. Each one was very proud of the fact that each one was separate and distinct and free to do as they please.
Thanks. Besides designing the covers to your books and giving you the title, Millennial Hospitality, I am very proud of the fact that I told you to include your Hall Photon Theory in the appendix of the third book, because it seemed to me that we're living in kind of a situation that is the reverse of what Galileo was facing. Back then, the religious were kind of inside the box, and Galileo wanted to look for answers outside the box, whereas today it seems like the physicists all over the world have been happy to promote Einstein's notion that couldn't travel faster than the speed of light, and whereas the major religions and particularly the Catholic Church has been very open to some new thinking. And so I was thinking that maybe you might like to tell us a little more about Hall Photon Theory and
Yes. I have a master's degree in nuclear physics, and during the time that I was out on the ranges watching the tall whites, I also got to see their scout craft and their deep space craft up close. And I believe I understand at least the basic principles of how they work. The scout craft had a double hull construction. They had an inner hull and an outer hull, as the deep spacecraft had a similar kind of construction. And then in the case of the scout craft, in between those two hulls, there was, I estimate, 1,000 miles of fiber optic winding. And then what they had was these battery-like things that would generate subatomic particles. The subatomic particles clearly put out anti-gravity. And then the coils functioned in a manner similar to the way an electromagnet functions with the electrons. The coils amplified the anti-gravity field, and so the scout craft moved and pushed on the Earth's gravity field. That was how they got their propulsion, by pushing against the gravity, pushing using anti-gravity to push against the existing gravity field. I thought about that for many years, and I now have, in Hall photon theory, I wrote up a scientific paper, which is in the appendix of book 3, and I describe how I feel a human scientist should analyze famous experiments, such as the Michelson-Morley experiment, the Waterfill telescope experiment, toroidal coils, where I believe you can see more to physics than what has been discovered. I believe that in each photon of light, there are 3 physically real fields. Existing theory says there are only 2, an electric field and a magnetic field. All photon theory says there's a 3rd field inside the photon, and that you can see it at work in the Michelson-Morley experiment. And therefore, Einstein's relativity is not correct. That you can use that 3rd field to streamline the spacecraft and to push against gravity and perform other physically real tasks. And by so doing, build a spacecraft that can take off from the Earth, quickly accelerate to speeds faster than that of light, you know, make the deep space crossing, slow down and land, and so on. I'm certain that's what the Paul White deep spacecraft were doing. I'm certain the deep spacecraft were routinely traveling between the stars at speeds faster than the speed of light. And that's what I'm trying to describe in Hall photon theory. I believe that Maxwell's 4 equations need to be expanded to 6 or perhaps 8 to include the workings of the 3rd field inside the photon. I don't want to get into too much technical detail in this short interview, but if you'll, in the appendix of my 3rd book, remember that Hall photon theory is perfectly real, and it is as real as every event in my 3 book series.
Thanks. I have a few questions here from Nick. He asks, do you believe that there is an agreement between the Paul Whites and the government regarding the change of medical or other humanitarian concerns? And if so, what is your guess as to what it might be?
Well, based on my personal experience, I'm certain that the Paul Whites and the U.S. government have an agreement that if they're in trouble and the U.S. government is able to help them, the U.S. government will. And vice versa, that if we're in trouble, and if they're able to help, they will. Many men who served out at Indian Springs before me had come across the Paul Whites. In my weather shacks, I had log books that went back at least 7 years prior to 1965. And one common way for the weathermen to encounter the Paul Whites is if they were out in the desert and it looked like they were sick or in need of help. The Paul Whites would come and ask if they needed help. You see, in my first book, Millennial Hospitality, I described the night that I was very sick and I was out at the range 3 days, and I was vomiting and I was so sick I couldn't stand up. I'd raised the gate, and I was down on my knees next to the anti-tank ditch, which is out there, as I describe in my book, and the tall white lady known as the teacher came and asked me if I was going to die and if I wanted her to call my friends for help. And I was so sick, I thought I was hallucinating, as I described in my book. And so I'm certain that medical information and things like that are routinely exchanged between the tall whites and the American government.
Do you believe that the tall whites practice any form of religion or worship of any kind? And if so, what type of dogmas or rites do they practice?
Well, when the tall whites came, they never came to tell me anything. They came for their purposes. Usually it was, as I describe in my books, a common reason was so that their children could play and have fun where I was, because the tall whites have men, women, and children, and a common reason for them to come was so the children could play and look through my theodolite as I was tracking balloons and releasing balloons. However, they clearly practiced tit for tat. If you didn't harm them, they wouldn't harm you. When they came, if you could just stand there and overcome your fear, you know, if you could just not panic and just say, you know, and not do anything harmful to them, they would never do anything harmful to you. And in a sense, that's a religious principle. They practice that the way we, you know, as a love your neighbor thing, or, you know,
golden rule.
As a golden rule thing, do unto others. If, on the other hand, if you were to harm them or hurt their children, they were quite proud of their ability to protect themselves. They never discussed religion with me, but as you see in my books, for example, in book one, the day that I was out in the Range 3 Lounge in the final chapter, the teacher was explaining to the crowd that I believed in God, and they all understood that concept. She did not have to further explain to the people who were there the concept of God. And she said he prays when we come around, and he believes that his God will protect him from us. And they all understood that. She didn't have to explain that religious concept of God or praying. So for that reason, I believe they do have a religion. They loved each other. The parents loved the children. The children loved the parents. They were that kind of society. So I believe that they do have a religion, but they just never chose to discuss the details with me.
Thank you so much. I'm not even sure if we have time for another question, mm-hmm. but maybe we'll just run out the clock. I want to I want to remind people that our website is millennialhospitality.net, and on the website they can get in contact with us and ask questions of their own if they have them, as I'm sure they may after reading the book. This next question is, did the tall whites describe any of the other alien races they encountered? And if so, what details do you remember?
As you see in my books, one night after I'd gotten used to being around the tall whites, and as you see, it took me a long time to get over my fear of them. It took me more than 6 months to get over the fear, the terror, the emotion I felt when they came around. But one night in 1966, after I was used to being around them, they had come with the children, and the children were playing. And after I had finished the balloon run, I walked over to the lady whose name, what CIA name was the teacher, and I asked her how life on Earth compared with life on other inhabited planets that she'd seen. And she said that there were quite a few planets nearby in space that were inhabited, that they had seen quite a few of them. She said that humans were the only ones that they knew of that did things with animals. She pointed out that I grew up in a farm in Wisconsin, and that I felt quite comfortable milking cows, riding horses, playing with dogs. She pointed out that each one of those animals could kill me, but I never thought of it that way. Instead, I just naturally used my intelligence to decide how the animal was thinking and then went off and made friends with it. She said that was very unusual. She said that on the other planet, the intelligent beings were plant eaters and wouldn't have anything to do with them. She herself only ate plants. And the tall whites themselves did not have pets. They did not bring animals with them or keep animals as pets. And she said that on most planets, as soon as the intelligent species evolved, the first thing they did was kill off all the animals. And all the animals would be a threat. And so she pointed out that it was so unusual for me to be, on the one hand, the intelligent being, and on the other hand, trying to use that intelligence to decide how an animal like a horse or a cow, an animal of lesser intelligence, how it was thinking.
This is a good question. What are your thoughts as to how your tall white experience changed your outlook? And do you feel that you might be contacted again by the tall whites or the government?
Well, I'm Roman Catholic, and I've always been very religious. And as you see in my books, there were many nights where I was so terrified that I wasn't actually able to move my feet for a little while because I was so afraid, and I did a lot of time praying. And meeting the tall whites did not really change my religious views as much as a person might suppose, because I was always very religious, and I always believed that I have two guardian angels and that God is with me wherever I go. However, I remember one day in the summer of 66, it was a nice warm day, and I was out at Range 3, and I was watching one of the alien scout craft come down the valley towards me. And it was coming down in perfect silence, as usual, and it was floating on the gravity field. And it wasn't coming straight towards me. It was coming a little bit off, going to come a little bit off to my left, because I was out in front of my weather shack, and it was going to land behind the Range 3 lounge. And I remember as I stood there watching, it occurred to me that the human scientists, believing Einstein, believing that you couldn't travel faster than the speed of light, that you couldn't put out reverse gravity and so on, I remember the shock of realizing that all the human scientists were wrong. And that for me was one of the biggest of the cultural shocks, was realizing that all the human scientists who claimed to be so, you know, have such penetrating insight, the thought things through so carefully, had all missed it. Because it occurred to me that if seeing that there's more to physics than what Einstein was aware of was so simple or so obvious that the aliens themselves had not just found it and harnessed it, but were routinely using it. They were using the scout craft the way we use cars. It must not be that hard to see. And that was one of the biggest ways it changed me, was that shock of how could all of the human physicists have been so wrong. Now when I look at things like the writings of Einstein, for example, liked to do his thought experiments. He used to like to say, well, what if the one spacecraft were out in space, another one were approaching it at 99% speed of light, and put out a beam of light, measure the speed of light, what would he get? And then Einstein would pretend to know the answer. And now that looks so foolish to me, because you say, well, you don't know the answer until you do the experiment, you know? And it doesn't prove relativity right or wrong at all, because the alien craft were clearly streamlined to travel faster than the speed of light, the same way that a jet fighter plane is streamlined to travel faster than the speed of sound. And so, that was one of the biggest ways it changed me, was that realization that all the human scientists were missing it.
A number of people wanted to know why the female tall whites were so interested in obtaining human fashion. And they were wondering what the major differences were between their home planet clothing and ours.
Well, the lady tall whites, they like pretty clothes just as human women do. The tall whites have a very dry sense of humor. They like to make jokes and laugh. And the teacher used to have this dry joke. She used to like to make fun of the Air Force generals. She used to point out that in the commissary that the tall whites had on their main base up in the mountain, everything in the commissary was picked for them by the American generals, including the ladies' clothes that were available for sale to the tall whites. Of course, all the generals were old men. As she pointed out, all the human generals were old men who didn't know anything about fashion. And so she and the other tall white ladies used to like to make fun of how dismal the clothes looked that the generals would provide them. In my weather shack, I have a copy of the Sears catalog and the Montgomery Ward's catalog and the JCPenney catalog. And the tall white ladies used to like to come and look through the catalogs specifically at the ladies' clothing sections. And it wasn't at all uncommon to see tall white when they would come around in the morning, especially newly arrived tall whites, probably wearing clothes that they'd gotten from Sears or from Montgomery Ward's or Penney's.
Did the tall whites describe any of the other alien races they encountered? And if so, what details do you remember?
The tall whites only described the other alien races to the extent that I've already described. The tall whites, when they came, one time I asked the teacher how they wanted me to react when they came. It was a morning where I was unusually nervous because there were quite a few of them, and I wasn't afraid of them anymore, but on the other hand, they always came with guards, and they always came heavily armed, and so I was naturally a little nervous to have a large number of them around. And the teacher stated that what they wanted was for me to enjoy being around them while they were here. And for that reason, the tall whites, and that seemed to be the philosophy of the tall whites, I was just an enlisted man, and they didn't see any reason to describe anything to me, you know, what other races looked like, or where they came from, or what other places were like. They wanted to just, it was, when they came to where I was, they were coming to have fun, and they weren't coming to teach me the history of the world, or anything like that. They were bringing their children, and what they wanted to do was to relax and enjoy themselves.
Thanks. Did you have any closing thoughts? Anything we might have missed?
I wanted to say that nothing I did was ever classified. One part of the agreement that the tall whites and the American generals had was that nothing I did would ever be classified, and that, as a weather observer, I was never part of a classified projects such as building an airplane or anything like that. I was the weather observer. Weather information is never classified. And when I came off the ranges, I did not bring anything with me. I did not bring any diaries or any log books or photographs. I came off the ranges with only my memories. The tall whites, It was my personal experience was that the tall whites are not supernatural. They're just ordinary creatures like us humans, or like humans who happen to have come here from another planet. They did not go backward or forward in time. They did not travel to other dimensions or anything. They were simply creatures like us who knew how to build spacecraft that could easily exceed the speed of light and therefore make the deep space crossing very quickly. They were naturally as afraid of us as we are of them, and it took them a while to overcome their fear of us, the same way that it takes a human a while to overcome the fear of the tall whites. Many newly arrived tall whites, for example, wouldn't come closer to me than a quarter mile. To them, I looked like sort of a big hairy gorilla. And it was only after they'd been here a while and gotten used to being around humans that they were willing to come, only the experienced dog whites were willing to come up, you know, up close to me and talk with me and so on. And it's my belief that they must have been here for quite some time. In book three, for example, the teacher is talking about the tall white lady whose CIA name is Pamela. And she stated that Pamela had been born in Indian Springs Valley when James Madison was president. And that was back in about the year 1812. I know that the ancient Greeks, the ancient Greek legends that go back as far back as 972 BC, refer to the star Arcturus as the Watcher star. The ancient Greeks believed that a group of, if you check the legends, you'll see the ancient Greeks believed that a group of tall white doves had come to earth from Arcturus. And when the men of ancient Greece were camping out on the slopes of Mount Olympus in the hot summer nights, they said that a group of tall white gods would come and stand around out just outside the range of the firelight and watch them as they came. And their description of these tall white gods matches the tall whites. I also note that the legend of Saint Germain in, oh, the Renaissance, I don't quote the year, but sometime in the 1700s, I note that the legend of Saint Germain, that Saint Germain is described in a manner similar to the way the tall whites are described. Saint Germain was described, for example, as never eating meat, and so on, and as being very widely traveled. Lastly, I note that the Indians here in Dona Ana County, here in New Mexico, which is the county that Las Cruces is in, that they have the legend of the ghost of Dona Ana County. The Indian legends go back as far as that the Indians can remember, and they were first, when the first Spanish came to New Mexico, the first Spanish were told by the Indians of the ghost of Dona Ana County. The ghost of Dona Ana County is clearly one of the tall whites. When you look at a map of New Mexico, you'll see that there's a place between Truth or Consequences and Las Cruces where the Rio Grande River bends to the west. And as far back as the 1500s, the Spanish recorded that when you were camping in the area in the warm summer nights, that a group of tall white ghosts would come out of the mountains northwest of there, which today are still quite desolate, or they're quite empty, and would stand around the campfire and watch them and watch everything they did, and that if you tried to approach the ghost, they would run away. These reports of the ghost of Dona Ana County are as recent as this summer, last summer, the year, you know, they're still going on today. I've personally met people who claim, for example, that their grandfathers saw the ghost of Dona Ana County. So I personally believe that the tall whites, that when people first see the tall whites, that they may easily confuse them with ghosts or with other entities, you know, because the first time you come across one of the tall whites out in the desert, you honestly feel like you're dreaming or that, you know, there's something the matter with you.
Thank you so much again, Don and Dr. Louise, for inviting us. And it was a lot of fun. Yep. We hope your audience enjoyed it as much as we did.
And I want to say thank you as well. We certainly enjoyed being on your show. And thank you very much for having us.
Mm-hmm. No? Mm-hmm. I guess one of the big problems we've been having is... I thought we were running out of time when we actually have a few minutes. One of the most interesting things that I read recently was an interview with Monsignor Corrado Balducci. He's kind of semi-retired and lives in Rome. And Paula Harris was interviewing him, and it's in her book, and she says, "Can you quote some church fathers who suggest the existence of life on other planets? I heard that Padre Pio said something of this nature." And Monsignor Corrado Balducci answers, "Yes, there are several. Don Andrea Beltrami, who was born in 1870 and died in 1897, was a Salesian father and servant of God, and he prayed for the possible inhabitants of other planets. And of the 16 booklets he wrote, one seems to deal with this topic. The second is the recently sanctified Padre Pio, who was canonized on June 16, 2002. He was asked, 'Father, some claim that there are creatures of God on other planets too.' And Padre Pio replied, 'What else? Do you think they don't exist and that God's omnipotence is limited to this small planet Earth? What else? Do you think there are no other beings who serve the Lord?' Another time someone asked him, Padre Pio, I think the Earth is nothing compared to other planets and stars. And his answer, again, exactly, yes. And we Earthlings are nothing too. The Lord certainly did not limit his glory to this small Earth. On other planets, other beings exist, and perhaps did not sin and fall as we did." And she further asks if, he's speaking officially for the Catholic Church. And, of course, he says, "These ideas are my own," but he didn't claim to represent the Vatican. However, he was told that the Holy Father, Pope John Paul II, had seen him on Italian TV several times and had followed his radio homilies, and if there had been some objection, he was sure that he would know about it. So he believed there would be no problem here. Anyway, I really enjoyed meeting Monsignor Corrado Balducci, who was here from Rome in Washington, D.C., and I was able to meet him in April. So how are we doing?
Those quotes are in Paul Harris's
book. I said that.
And that's in the
I said that already.
I don't think.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So, how are we doing?
We have a minute left.
A minute. I'll let you finish.
Well, thank you very much for having us on your show. I invite you to visit the Millennial Hospitality website at www.millennialhospitality.net, spelled the way it sounds. millennialhospitality.net. And if you have more questions, you should feel free to use the resources on the website to email us and ask questions. Thank you very much for having us.
Bye.